Right, let's welcome to the studio David Thomas, who is from the University of Wales at Bangor. Hi, David. Thank you for coming along. Now, you've got a new book out. It's Surviving in Antarctica. And I suppose as someone who's been to both the poles for his research, you have survived and come back. But it's a horrible place, isn't it? I mean, how cold is it at the poles?
Well, it must be said that we go mostly in the summer, so actually quite often we're working on the ice in T-shirts, because if the sun's at a high angle, it's just like being Switzerland and you know, and warmed by the sun. But at the South Pole, the coldest temperature has been minus 80 degrees centigrade, so about the same temperature as liquid nitrogen, really. So
that's
it's very
really
cold
quite
indeed.
Cold.
Yeah. It's pretty chilly. How does life survive there, or is it a barren wilderness with nothing?
No, there's plenty of bacteria that are living in this uppermost snow in the South Pole. And most of these organisms, they kind of go down into a kind of diapause or a hibernation, or they just go into resting stages until conditions get better. So myself, I study microscopic algae that got caught up into ice, into frozen seawater. And when temperatures get really very cold, they just switch down their metabolism to a basal rate and then wait for the conditions to get better. And that's a general principle. Same for polar bears, really, as well.
So if you look in the ice, it's not the sterile thing that we think it is. There's got a lot of life hidden in there.
There's a lot of viruses, there's a lot of bacteria. No, it's teeming with life. Even very ancient ice that is hundreds of thousands of years old has bacteria that have been brought back to life when this ice has been retrieved from these deep ice cores that people are taking in Greenland and in the Antarctic.
It's intriguing to me that we put into our deep freeze at home food to make sure that it won't go off. It suppresses the activity of life, which degrades food. That's at about minus 20. You're playing around in those temperatures and you've got things that you're saying are thriving. So yeah. How do they survive and flourish in those temperatures?
So we've actually got bacteria that are moving around at minus 20. So this is the same temperature as your freezer in the sea ice. And one of the things that they do is they produce a lot of slime and they produce a lot of mucus that they kind of protect their cells within and kind of sit in this gel-like body that buffers them against a lot of the temperature and also saline stresses that they may come into contact with.
Is it true that things like Unilever, big companies like them, have borrowed from biology and solved the problem of how to make smooth ice cream by nicking the chemistry that some of these microbes have invented for themselves?
There's a whole new industry of bioprospecting in the poles, and people are looking for enzymes that work at particularly cold temperatures, substances that make, as you say, ice cream smooth at cold temperatures. There's a whole group of industries that are out there that are really looking to the poles for solving many of these kind of problems.
But one of the things you said was, on a hot day, it can be like you're on the ski slopes in Switzerland and you have to be careful not to get burned because there's lots of UV and things. So two questions come out of that. One is, how do these organisms not actually get zapped by the UV? And B, if there's a massive hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica now, is that compromising these organisms?
A lot of the organisms that live down there are able to react very quickly to changing light conditions, and they're able to produce a whole string of pigments and also special amino acids that they kind of are able to basically produce their own sunscreens, if you like. And in turn, these microalgae and bacteria that produce these substances are eaten by things like the crustaceans, krill, as I gather you heard about last week. And they then take on this sunscreen by their diet, basically.
Oh, so one borrows from the other.
Exactly.
That's neat. So can we nick that and use this to make better sun creams for us?
I don't think we need to.
Especially if this ozone hole gets any bigger.
I don't think we need to. But one of the things, I mean, when the ozone hole was first identified, I mean, a lot of biologists got a lot of research money out of this because everybody thought, well, this was going to be catastrophic to biology in polar regions. But in fact, what I think the last 10 to 15 years of research has shown that it probably isn't as catastrophic as we first thought, that the biology is really able to cope pretty remarkably, actually.
So that's the hole in the ozone there. But what about the other big problem, which is said to be affecting Antarctica, which is global warming and melting? There's conflicting stories, because some people are saying, oh, some bits of Antarctica are getting warmer, some bits are getting colder. What's the real story, and how does this all fit together?
I think what's interesting here is that we do have regions of the Antarctic Peninsula, that is probably the area of the globe or the world that is heating up the most or at the fastest rate. But in general, it's thought that the Antarctic isn't really suffering as such from global climate change. Where the things are really happening is up in the Arctic, where we know that in 2050, so within our lifetimes, hopefully, there will be no sea ice, for instance, in the summer. There will be always sea ice in the winter, but there will be no sea ice in the summer in the 2050s.
And what's melting it?
just increasing temperatures. The temperatures are increasing dramatically over the past 30 years.
Is that the sea temperature? So it's melting from beneath, or is that the air temperature? It's melting from above.
It's both, actually. So both. And you know, the thought of an ice-free Arctic, well, it's great for the shipping companies that are going to be able to use the Northwest Passage and the Northeast Passages, but for things like the polar bears that are getting so much press at the moment, but also for the whole ecosystem, because there's a whole ecosystem that's based on having a frozen ocean for a whole year up in the Arctic. Well, of course, we don't know what the consequences are going to be.
Don't polar bears do something clever when they walk across ice, because they can in some way intuitively test whether it'll take them?
They kind of splay their legs out and they kind of crawl so they're spreading the load of their body. But it doesn't really matter if they fall through, to be quite honest. Polar bears are tremendous swimmers anyway.
Now, you said that Antarctica isn't suffering that much, but what about the fact that ice sheet Larsen B and the other ones which we've seen previously to now, they've actually been of the order of thousands of square kilometres of ice, haven't they? So is that not significant then?
Yeah, it's certainly significant, but these kind of ice shelf breakups have been happening throughout geological time, and so they're part of a natural process. An ice shelf comes to an end and breaks off. It is true, though, Larsen B is on the Antarctic Peninsula, and it is very likely that that's associated with the warming of the peninsular area.
Do you think, then, that it's too late from this global warming point of view? Are we going to see unequivocal losses that we can't remedy, both in terms of the ecosystems and those environments? Or do you think if we do start acting now, we can turn things around?
No, I don't think we can start turning things around. And cyclical changes like this have been well known in geological time. I mean, in the past, there was tropical plants growing up in the Arctic region. So this is nothing new. What we've done, I think, in the last couple of hundred years is we've just increased the rate of change of something that was happening quite naturally. And my guess is we can't turn things around. We're not going to stop this pack ice going in the Arctic. But it must be said that many of these changes, you know, we've seen big cycles in climate change in the past. So
I suppose it's good news as my sort of final point for fishermen, because up in the Northern Hemisphere, where they've been restricted by quotas and declining fish stocks, some of them have taken to catching icebergs instead, haven't they? I did read one wonderful story where there's quite a big market for the water locked up in icebergs now.
There has been lots of ideas throughout time of, you know, taking icebergs and dragging them to Arabian countries as well as a source of fresh water, and this is an idea that doesn't seem to ever go away.
But there must be quite a lot of water locked up in an iceberg. It must be millions of tons, isn't
there? There's massive amounts of water, I mean, and especially when you kind of add up the amount of water that's in an ice shelf or on an ice cap. It's just staggering amounts. I mean,
thank you, David. That's David Thomas. He's from the University of Wales at Bangor, and he's written a book which has come out. It's called Surviving Antarctica. He's got another book out in hardback, which is called Frozen Oceans, and it's been published by the Natural History Museum. I think Frozen Oceans is, and I'm not being sycophantic just because he's here in the studio, this is one of the best books I've actually probably ever read, and I've read a few, about the ecosystems down in both Antarctica and also up in the Arctic. And it gives a really amazing and vivid account both of ice science and also the life science that's associated with the ice science. And we're going to put links about that on our website, because it's a really wonderful book, Frozen Oceans. And thank you very much, David, for coming and talking to us about it.
Thank you.
That's right. I'm going to have a look at that book myself. It looks fantastic.
Laying the facts bare, the Naked Scientists.